Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs and founders that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners will know, I am a founder of a healthcare venture myself called PocDoc. PocDoc support the show. PocDoc, as people, regular listeners will know, is revolutionizing the way that screening for cardiovascular disease is done by enabling anyone to do it with their smartphone or tablet, generating blood marker values and a full heart risk assessment inside of 8 minutes in clinical and non-clinical environments. So that's all very exciting. Thanks, as ever, to the UK Health Radio team for the platform, for the live platform. Johan and his team do a fantastic job. It's not just me on the station. There's lots of other presenters doing lots of other great content. And so thank you to everyone that's listening live right now. Thank you also if you are listening on any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Google, Amazon Music, Apple, or Acast. Or if you're watching us on YouTube, where we syndicate this out, or if you're, you know, looking at one of the clips. So thank you very much for listening. We realize now, we looked at the data and we have listeners in over 45 countries every month, which is amazing. And it's growing. So thank you very much. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you guys. Just also a note, you can get all of the UK Health Radio shows, not just ours, but all of them on the UK Health Radio channel on the podcast platforms. So you can either come to the Health Tech Hour channel or you can go to the UK Health Radio channel where all of the shows are available. So last week we had Brian Plakis-Cheng on from OpenRad, who are revolutionizing the radiology space, trying to unblock or free up capacity in the NHS and other healthcare systems by making it easier to process x-rays and MRI scans through the system. That actually had an amazing response across the board, both from clinicians and just from people. It seemed to be a topic that really resonated with people. So thank you very much for all of your comments and questions and you know, likes and shares of all of that content. If you want to go and listen to it, you can go check it out on Spotify right now. It's episode 83. So let's turn to this week. This week, we have Sophie Park on the show, who is one of the most experienced digital health advisors in the world. She is currently a managing director at the pharma giant Bayer and an advisor to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm sorry. So Bayer, for those of you who don't know, is one of the largest pharmaceutical businesses in the world, actually based in a place called Leverkusen, where I have actually been many times for random reasons. But yes. So Sophie, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Steve. Doing very well. Excited to be on here. Excited to always talk about digital health and my opinions in that space. People will listen.
Well, you know, they can turn off if they want to, but I'm sure that they won't. So where are you calling from today? Where are you actually based?
I am actually calling from Boston, but I'm supposed to be based in Berlin, actually. Our entire team is out in Berlin, but I've been in Boston for about a year now. And so I go back and forth.
Okay. Not in Leverkusen.
Jesus, no.
No?
I mean, I shouldn't say it that way, but no, definitely no. Not in Leverkusen.
Well, but there's a difference between Berlin and Leverkusen, which is why I suspect that people are in Berlin.
Two different worlds, yeah. But actually, we have our new innovation hub here. It's called the BRIC. For Research Innovation Center. And so Bayer recently just opened that. Actually, it was actually opened right before the pandemic.
Right.
So that kind of set things back. But yeah, we do have a big space here. And so I'm usually back and forth. But here, it's a lot of biotech. And I'm obviously digital health. So
does BRIC stand for Bayer Research and Innovation Center by any chance?
It does.
I like that. Yes. That's a good, That's a good
The brick.
acronym.
Yeah.
The brick. Yeah, that's
The
good.
brick.
All
Because
right,
it's
cool. Well,
literally a
look,
brick building, too.
that's good. So, what we normally do on the show is we kind of take a bit of a journey through how you've gotten to where you are today, and like your journey on, because I know that you've done lots of different things and lots of exciting things, both in the kind of private space, but also in the not-for-profit space. And I know that you've got a lot of thoughts and views on digital health just generally. I think I'd really like to delve into what the some of the things around pharma, big pharma, if you like, and particularly why and how big pharma is interested in digital health, right? As like pharmaceutical businesses that generally are geared around making drugs, why and how is digital health becoming a component of that, right? Which I think is a much bigger topic about how you kind of fuse those two worlds. And then we can just have a a chit chat. How about that?
Yeah, for sure. Love
Cool.
that. Well, I can start. I
Please.
will say, my life has not been that long yet, according to me. But
Okay.
let's see. So my background is actually in economics and public health. And I don't think I've ever wanted to be in healthcare, to be honest. It kind of happened
Right.
in a way. And I guess that's usually what happens for a lot of people. But I was kind of in this finance track. I have a lot of friends in private equity and investment banking now. Actually, most
Okay.
all of my friends are there, except for myself. But I knew for a while that public health was something that, that I wanted to get into. And, the reason being is, actually, I'm from an ex inc I don't know how far back we want to go about my history, but not very many people know,
Yeah.
actually, Steve.
Yeah.
Nobody knows about my history, not even a lot of my colleagues. So maybe we can talk about it
I
here.
hope it's not you're not like part of some witness protection program, because if you are, you really shouldn't use this
Well,
platform to come clean. Yeah, don't bring
actually,
that
Steve, my name is not Sophie.
up. I
No.
mean, how far back do you want to go? You can choose how far back you'd like to go. Was that an open question?
Let's talk about this because it's important for the public history. It is a public history, but it's important for public health. So, I'm actually from a very, very small town in California called
Okay.
El Centro.
Okay.
They actually became incredibly famous across the US during the recession of 2008,
Okay.
not because of some grandeur opportunity, but because it was the single city in the United States with nearly 99% unemployment rate in 2008.
Wow. 99%.
N nearly 99%. It was like 98.8. It's on Wikipedia. You can look it up.
Wow, what happened? Why?
Right, about that. That's a lot of public policy now, but
Okay. Yeah.
it's a huge agricultural city,
Okay.
tons of migrants. There's a lot of international companies. It's a bordering town of California to Mexico, a
Okay.
city in Mexico called Mexicali. There's a lot of international employers there. There's a lot of federal employers there as well.
Okay.
One of the larger judiciary courts, I think, are based there. But there's one single hospital that covers nearly an entire region of maybe 360,000
Wow, that's a
people
lot of
or
people.
residents. Right. But again, an entire region, right?
Yeah.
And that was actually my first experience. I don't even remember how old I was back then, but all I remember, Steve, was even though our family had a general practitioner, even though we did have insurance. What was really interesting to me is that it was so difficult to even get an appointment for a flu vaccine.
Right.
And so my mother would take us to the community clinic. It was the public health clinic that was set up by, obviously the public health authorities.
Yeah.
And so it was so much easier to find clinicians there. And they were clinicians coming in from San Diego, from
Okay.
Orange County. And so that was actually my experience with healthcare. And
Okay.
I think part of that really had to do with a lot of the journey into going into public health, going into economics. So Now, fast forward, I still ended up deciding to stay in healthcare. And for a while, I was an independent consultant
Okay.
for a while, at least like 5 years. And honestly, it was really fun. I picked up quite a few projects here and there. I've worked with the Office of Innovation, the White House, through the White House back in the day. And I was a part of the Blue Button Initiative, the large project that, the Office of Innovation decided to set up and say, hey, look, why don't patients have access to their own data in the United States? I don't
Yeah.
know. So they thought maybe it's a good idea to set up a platform where people can do that. So we actually rolled it out with the VA. So that's kind of a little bit on like the public side. And then on the private side, this back what when the year was? It's like 2010 maybe. And this is when a lot of private companies started getting really interested about health technology. But health tech was always there. It's just back in the day, it was called e-health or like mobile health, right? We've
Yeah.
all heard of those before. Big data, Internet of Things, and people still say that. And there, it was that moment in time where I did become involved in a lot of technology projects. And I don't know if it's because, I was already living in San Francisco. That
Right.
probably had to do with it because we're in Silicon Valley. But then people started realizing, oh, technology has always been a thing, and healthcare is still inundated with a bunch of problems, a bunch of inefficiencies. Maybe digital health can help, right?
Yeah.
Not only help people live healthier lives, but help physicians with workflows and, fix
Maybe
a lot of
there
inefficiencies.
might be a way for it to help. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe, right? That's what people were
Maybe.
saying back then.
Open question.
Potentially, there is potential. I believe I heard that saying quite a few times. And so, from government to private institutions, there was a lot of requests coming in. And so I was actually really fortunate enough to work with, actually, Bayer used to be one of my clients back in the
Oh,
day.
nice.
This program, actually, they used to be called Grants for Apps, but I
Okay.
do remember that email coming in and my boss being like, do you want to take up this project? It's a big pharma trying to go digital. And I was
Yeah.
like, pharma, really?
Yeah.
And now it's history, right?
Yeah.
But no, a lot of consulting companies too. Listen, the McKinseys, the BCGs of the world, they had no idea what they were doing back, like literally 10 plus years ago,
Yeah.
right? In digital health. And so, yeah, this
Was
is
there any
kind of how.
like how much like clinician involvement was there back in the day? Because like to your point around the BCGs and the McKinseys, who people pay huge amounts of money to advise on things, like how connected was it? Like people actually going and talking to clinicians and being like, tell us the problems that you have. Let's try and get under the skin of the user stories. Let's figure out these requirements. Let's go. Or is it kind of completely separate?
No, completely separate, absolutely none. I think there was always like this handful of clinicians that are, big advocates of digital health. But back
Yeah.
then, it's kind of how the startup world starts, right? Like a startup thinks of
Yeah.
a great idea, only thinks about, the consumer, never thinks about anyone else that's supposed to use their product. It was kind of like that, but it was completely separate.
Yeah.
Not zero clinician interaction, but I would say very, very little. And it was very separate. I know the American Medical Association, I mean, they weren't, they I don't think they had digital health
Right.
topics back in the day. And as they did, it was just, again, a few handful of clinicians who said, oh, this could be interesting. Medical school education, forget it. There was nothing there. I remember there were several professors back in the day who actually said to me, there would never be a point in time where a physician can ever see a patient on Skype.
That's what they said.
Yeah.
Amazing. I love that.
I believe the precursor was don't be ridiculous. There will never be a moment in time where a physician's interaction can ever be over, you can't be prescriptive over the phone. You can't be prescriptive
Yeah,
over Skype, you know?
I remember when Babylon Health, which we can kind of come onto and chat about, which just completely flamed out. But I remember when they started in the UK, that was basically like the general position was, don't be silly. No one's ever going to do a virtual GP appointment. Like, that won't ever work. Not just from the GP perspective, but they were like, patients don't want that. It's like, patients as this like generic group. You mean like there's no patient that would prefer it? Like, there's no pay, like, it's kind of
Right,
interesting.
right, right. Like, who are you really talking about? And I think that's kind of the beauty of technology, right? And I think that's where a lot of people don't understand, because technology is, again, very consumer, right? It
Yeah.
doesn't matter if a doctor doesn't want to use it. Like, there will be patients who ask for it. And I think that's what's been happening in the last couple of years, where there's also a push but a pull, right?
Yeah.
Where people are asking, like, why doesn't your clinic have virtual scheduling? Why are you giving me pieces of paper? Could you send
Yeah.
me a PDF to my email? Can you send me a text reminder? Why do I need to circle it on my wall calendar? You know, like,
So like in the US, so in the US, so you're where which is where you are now, and Germany,
yeah.
but I think there's an issue in the UK. This is just me, like, spitballing, but I don't know what you think. But for the most part, the healthcare system doesn't necessarily treat the patient as a customer, right? And the patient doesn't have really a huge amount of choice. Now, there are obviously some people that self-select and go private, but even then, they don't really have a choice. Like, it's not in the same way as, like, okay, well, I could go to Sainsbury's or Tesco's or Waitrose to do my shopping. I can get the same products in each one, and I can change and I can swap, or I can use Uber or Bolt, or I could get a black cab, or I actually have a freedom of choice there, which then obviously flows down into how those businesses compete against each other, the services, the pricing, the offerings. Like, it separates those incentives. Whereas, like, in healthcare, they don't, it's not really the same thing. Like, I guess in America and other places, you can shop around between insurance providers and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, if your general practitioner does it in that particular way, the burden and friction of you changing, even if you can change, is like really high, you know?
Right. And, you know, it's fascinating too, because I think in the UK, yes, but that's still a lot more freedom than most other European countries, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone comes with a lot of, you know, I think a lot of issues in health. I mean, we all know healthcare has a lot of issues. But for example, in the US, I mean, I think it also is about, like, the education, right? Like, people don't really know where to go. Like, and also, even though you have technology at your fingertips, you have, you know, Google, you can always look it up. It's very rarely that, like, people will be able to find these services that, you know, they either love or that they really need. Because, again, I think the intrinsic value of healthcare right now across the world is, like, emergency services, technically, right?
Yeah.
Like, unless you really need it, you're not going to go out and look for it. So I think
Yeah.
part of it has to do with, you know, the education side of it, like, us understanding and us knowing that these things are out there. Because I know that there's probably a startup for to order prescription, like, online. There's probably four, right?
Yeah,
But
at
then, do
least.
other people know that, at least? And so I think part of it has to do with that. But then again, yeah, you're right. Like, you really don't have a freedom of movement in healthcare. And I don't know. Some people like that. Some people think, you know, it's okay to have these sets of standardized, right? Let's
Yeah.
call it standardized places where you can go and then find one person. You don't like the doctor, oh well.
Yeah.
You know? And then there's another format where it's, you know, if you don't like the doctor, then you can probably go find another one, or probably find other opportunities somewhere else. But yeah, I don't
But I mean,
know.
is there something unique about health that means that it's sort of different to other categories? Like, to the point around, that we were talking about before, is like, well, then, when digital health, I mean, there was always technology. So, this kind of, I don't know, sort of fake explosion of suddenly, oh, look, let's make health digital. Sort of like, okay, cool. Then there's lots of startups that started to do different bits and bobs. But I felt, to begin with, at least, it was very geared around the systems. It was like big IT infrastructure, efficiency, like things like in that sense, data related stuff. And actually, like some of the patient-facing stuff started to come in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, but that might be wrong.
No, you're right. But God, this is like a you're opening a can of worms,
Well,
I
that's
think.
we got
Because
another
it's
40 minutes,
okay, that's good. That's good. Yeah, because healthcare is so different, right? Like you don't use healthcare the same way I use healthcare, right? And not and your neighbor probably doesn't use it the same way. And I think part of this is exactly the reason why I went into public health, because it's so social determinants, right? And I know people only use it. I hate it when people only use social determinants to determine like underprivileged societies, because it's not, that's incorrect, right? We're all a part of this umbrella of social determinants. And when 80% of your healthcare is determined by where you live, how much money you make, whether you're male or female, then it opens like a whole nother world of, who uses it, why do they use it, where do we find the best opportunities, right? And so I think healthcare is so different in that way, and this is why it's so convoluted. Right. Like,
There's so
can
many
you can't
industries all in one.
yes, because like you said, big data, all of that stuff, yes, it's there. Although, is it good enough yet? I don't know. I don't think
I
so.
don't, I mean,
I
we still don't really have complete universal electronic health records, do we, in the UK or the US or Germany? I don't know if we do. I'm not sure about France and
No,
Spain and Italy. I'm not sure.
we don't, right? And this has been around for decades, right?
Yeah,
So why
exactly.
isn't it available in healthcare? And I think, again, like these tools and platforms, et cetera, right, that are also coming out, again, you can't use it cross-border. It's meant for a very certain set of people. And it's also coming from like the startup side. It's super frustrating, right? Because then you have investors where you're saying, investors want you to make an exit in 4 years. And it's like, this is healthcare. You do realize that the deficit in healthcare, like people talk about the healthcare market being what, like over $100 billion. In the US, we have a debt of over $1 trillion. That's not profit. That's all debt. This is what people have to realize. Healthcare is not a profit. Remember that healthcare is a debt. Right? I think this is the biggest issue that we see, but that's
No, I think
a whole
well, we can
nother.
pick this up. So my producer Johan is saying that we need to go to our first commercial break.
Oh,
So we're going to be
okay.
right back with Sophie Park from Bayer Pharmaceuticals and other luminary places. After 2 minutes, we'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Sophie Park, Managing Director at Bayer Pharmaceuticals, not Bayer Leverkusen, the football club, Bayer Pharmaceuticals, the pharmaceutical business.
I wish.
Sorry, kind of like a bit of an automatic brain fade there. And before the break, we were kind of digging into the differences around healthcare, health tech, how to develop businesses, what's different, what's not. I want to sort of switch it up a little bit and pick up on something that we talked about in the introduction, which is how does Big Pharma or how has Big Pharma been doing, is doing digital? Because traditionally, and you jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but we're a broad church of listeners. So I want to kind of make sure we're all on the same page. Pharma companies, generally speaking, historically, made drugs to sell to people, to treat diseases, treat conditions, vaccinate people, whatever it ultimately was. That was there, which is very much a physical product being churned out at volume, at scale, and so on. So, like, how have they kind of coped with this digital explosion, digital health?
They're coping.
Coping,
coping.
coping.
Listen, there's, gosh, pharma has a long way to go. I've only been in the, my colleagues have been in this industry much longer than I have, but I've only been in it for what, still less than 10 years, right? And a lot has changed in terms of what pharma can do, what pharma has done. in the innovation space and also digital. But let's talk about digital specifically. I'm not talking about, biotech and the R&D aspect of it, but listen, pharma are generally not device companies. They're
No.
not software companies
No.
either. They're not cloud and data infrastructure companies. They're not SAP, right?
No.
And it's been a huge hurdle. And I mean, just even working at Bayer alone, right? I will say, I can't say that there hasn't been strides because there are, right? A lot of pharma companies are doing their part. A lot of, like, even Novartis and even Pfizer, right? They're offering their consumers digital products, right? In conjunction or what we like to call companion tools, right? But I think the biggest question a couple of years ago that many pharma companies had was, can we go beyond a companion product, right? Like, can we go beyond what's, within our portfolio? But again, right, in order to be an AI company, in order to be a data company, you also need to have those skill sets,
Yeah, well,
right?
I think it's like a bit, so let's dial it back a sec. So it's interesting you brought up Novartis. So the company that my company Popdoc, we work with Novartis. We were part of the heart health catalyst, so
Oh,
around trying
nice.
to increase access to lipid testing. You test more people for lipids, you analyze their heart risk, you can get more people on statins into treatment and so on. And therefore, you lower the incidence of heart attacks, both in primary and secondary prevention. So that all makes sense. And I think this area of companion things is like the obvious one. It's sort of like company A makes a drug, everyone uses a phone. So can we make an app that helps people adhere to the drug or take more of the drug or demonstrate efficiency or demonstrate how good the drug is or whatever it is? It's sort of like it either helps the system to distribute the drug or helps the person take the drug, all of which is like designed towards the same endpoint, either on a micro level with the person or a macro level with a kind of a country or a system. So that, like, I think that that's sort of like entry level, right? And
Absolutely, but
like,
it's still so difficult. I mean, I don't know what your experience was working with Novartis, but again, it's so difficult for pharma companies to even scale, even though we have the talent inside, right? We have market access, we have, pharmacovigilance, we have the ability to scale. But again, like we don't always know how to scale tech companies.
well, I think it's a
Right.
bit like what's the so what factor here for a pharma? It's sort of like where's the why here, which is sort of like, yes, they could build an AI function, they could develop a device, they could have loads of them have innovation hubs and startup competitions and incubating and all this other kind of stuff, and it still just comes around to the why. So a really good example, the one of the best examples that I can find and have come across is something that Roche do. Roche, tomato, tomato. And they're one of the largest medical device manufacturers in the world. They have their own incubation where they bring on smaller medical device manufacturers or startups or things that are already devices that then they want to integrate up into the larger Roche ecosystem. You get the benefit of Roche's scale, et cetera, et cetera. That makes sense to me. That I get because you're bringing up, it's almost like what farmers do with biotechs, which is like there are little biotechs springing up doing their own research. And when things look promising, pharma kind of can scoop them up or scoop up the compounds and scale up and things like that. It's sort of like a part of this, it's part of the same spectrum. Where I slightly struggle with it is sort of why a big pharma would start to dabble too much in something that is not necessarily aligned with their drug portfolio or, what they're trying to do. I think it's a, I'm not saying I have the answer. I just start to sort of question it a bit more. That's all.
I think there's a lot of factors in that. It's not, you can always say, right, like there may not be a drug in the portfolio for that, but it's because there are certain indications within the within diseases that are
Yeah.
crossovers, right? Like certain comorbidities that are always there. So for
Yeah.
example, like we do know that many of our disease areas, like one of the comorbidities or one of like the general overlapping indication is mental health.
Right.
Right. And I bet that
although overlaps
Fox,
over quite a lot of things, I suspect.
like tons, right? Tons of it, right? And so it's like, why are we not? Because I think ultimately, at the end of the day, regardless of what people think of Big Pharma, I think there are still very good people working for these companies. And I think at the end of the day, these people are trying to make the lives of people better, right? People that use their products,
Well,
people that use their services.
Pick up on that while you, let's pick up on that now you mention it, like, which is kind of like this idea where, and look, let's be completely clear, and I have to be careful what I say, because if you say too much about the pandemic, then Spotify flags the podcast. So
Really?
yeah, they like AI scrape what we're saying, so it's kind of interesting. Yeah, and they put like a little flag on the episode and stuff like that. So anyway, yeah, it's mad even
So
now.
bizarre.
Yeah, it's kind of bonkers, isn't it? It's so like,
We've been
so,
flagged.
but what I was going to say, this obviously got exacerbated by the pandemic because of farmers' role in the vaccines and all that kind of other stuff. But like, I think pharma does get a bit of a bad rep, right? In general, because where does everybody think the antibiotics come from? Where does everyone think the cancer drugs come from? Where does everyone think any drug you take to make you, your family better, where do you think that comes from? Now, you could say it shouldn't come from Big Pharma. It should be developed in some altruistic, not-for-profit, something or other, which is fine. But like at some point, somebody has to pony up some money to do some R&D to actually move stuff and get it out. So I don't know. I mean, how would you think about this idea of pharma a force for good? Like, how would you kind of explain it?
I think pharma can be a force for good. I mean, somebody has to do it, right? It can't be a guy in their garage with three people doing it, right? You can't do that. Like, in order to scale drugs, it requires tons and tons of hours, lots of money to go into it. It's not, it truly takes a village internationally in multiple locations in order to get the right drugs to the right people. So I think at the end of the day, this whole thing about pharma being evil, yes, granted, there are maybe a couple. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Netflix show, but I'm not going to say which pharma it was, right? But there is a Netflix series where it really paints pharma in a terrible light. However, it does require a lot of energy and effort to do that. And I think, when pharma wants to go digital, granted, yes, there may not be the skill sets internally to scale it, but at the same time, I think pharma is now starting to understand that we need to offer holistic solutions. I hate using the word holistic, but I an all around
All
an all
encompassing.
around all encompassing, exactly, because we know that you are not your disease, right? And that even though you have cancer, we don't know what your caregivers are going through, what your physicians are going through. Can we help with a workflow solution? That's a part of, what we sell. And I think, from a business perspective, obviously it makes sense because then if it is all encompassing, right, people are more likely to utilize it. But then again, here's the aspect of technology. Technology has to be desirable. It has to be easy to use, like so easy to use that it's kind of like your iPhone. You don't know where your apps are, but you kind of know where they are. You know what I mean? It has to be that easy. Like the user experience of it has to be so flawless and seamless. And that's what health tech should be. That's what digital health should be. But we are definitely not there, right? And I think that's really what pharma is trying to do because I think they understand that, yeah, sure, like we can have a cancer drug, we can have a drug for heart failure. But again, a lot of these people require so much more upkeeping, right? Like we need to make sure we can monitor them remotely. Like, is there a way we can support with the wellness journey even
So,
so
and like,
that
I think one of the way, it's not, this is the thing, is like, it depends on how you define digital health. It's kind of a bit of an annoying phrase sometimes, I find. But like, let's take decentralized clinical trials for an example, right? Brain dead, nailed on, makes total sense to me, right? Which is, in this day and age, why do you need to be dragging large volumes of people to centralized locations when you could potentially monitor their blood values at home? By sending a kit to their house, they could milk their finger into a pot. Yes, that takes 15 minutes, and yes, it's kind of it's annoying and frustrating, but you could do it that way instead of, and that makes total sense. But I'm not even sure necessarily that classes is digital health, even though that technically the businesses that offer that claim that they are in digital health. It's like you're sending a kit to someone's house, they're filling up a pot and it's coming back to a laboratory. What is di what the results are
What
generated
is
by a
digital health?
computer and uploaded into a database, but they always were.
You know, Steve, but here's my wish, though. I hope that in the future that we no longer have to call technology used in healthcare digital health. Like it should
Right.
just be like, I don't know, the internet
Here's my
or
product. This is what it
technology.
does. This is my service.
Here's my product. Like I'm hoping that that's the direction that we're going because, again, technology is so consumer driven, regardless of if you're med tech, whatever, e-health, mobile health, digital health. I think ultimately, hopefully, ultimately down the line, it'll just be technology, right?
So
Just
what it
ease
reminds
of
me of when
use.
I, many moons ago, when I started my career, I started in advertising many, many, many years ago on a graduate scheme. And every advertiser, it was just at the basically the point where you could advertise on the internet and do different things. So each advertising agency had a digital unit, right? Separate from everything else. And it was called like digital advertising. And it was like, you know what I mean? It was
So,
like
like
anything that
on the
wasn't,
internet.
exactly, anything on the internet, right? It's kind of become a bit anachronistic now. Or like with Uber, no one says, "Oh, you know, it's just technology. It's tech business. It's a technology business." No one's like, "Oh, your digital cars, gotcha.
Your digital taxi?
Digital transport, got it."
Right,
It's just a
right,
bit prosaic.
right.
I think it's kind of. I too hope that that's the kind of direction that it's going in. The other thing that I get your view on this, but there was a story that broke in the UK. I think it was the UK. It might have been everywhere, but around antibiotic resistance. So I can't remember what prompted the story, but it was sort of, I think it was a clinician, another clinician, there's been many blowing the whistle, flagging that they had a patient who had been through every single antibiotic for a and the infection that they had resisted and beaten everything, including the last line, which is the what I can't remember what the name of the antibiotic is, but it's like the last line one that you use after you use 20 others, and that one almost certainly works, and it didn't. And so, and then there's this big debate where you have people saying, well, we have to solve this. This is a huge global emergency, which it is. And then they're like, well, we who's gonna develop the antibiotic? Oh, don't, yeah, pharma's gonna do it. And pharma's like, well, I mean, I could, but what, do you understand that we're talking about 10, 15 years worth of development, hundreds of millions of dollars? Like, and then it's gonna, and your view is it's gonna go generic. And like, so who's gonna fund, you want me to fund that? And it's like, it shows there's like a disconnect between this kind of expectation in public health and what an understanding of how drugs are developed, like a lack of reality, if that makes any sense. Like, I don't know what you think about it. I mean, clearly it's an emergency. I think antibiotic resistance is a massive, massive problem.
It is. It's a huge problem. And I will say it is a public health problem, but I do believe that there are other ways to kind of alleviate that problem. And I don't think the solution is to get multiple pharma companies to start an R&D process for multiple like stronger antibiotics. You know, I think that it's more around physician education. I think it's more around patient education. I think it's more around like, it has to do with economics rather than funneling more money into pharma trying to build even stronger antibiotics because that's clearly the problem
That's an
right now.
economic, it's an economic, I agree, and it but it's an economic issue in and of itself, because the farmer's saying, well, we don't really think there's a business case here, and we're a business, so we're not going to put our own money up or our investors' money up. If you'd like to give us the money to do it, we could probably figure it out. But this doesn't stack up in and of itself.
I mean, it technically doesn't. But again, at the same time, it's not the job of pharma companies to, I don't know, but this is a huge question, right? Is it a private pharma company's job to manage public health? Question mark.
It's a great question. I think it's a really interesting question, because who are pharma companies' number one customers is public health systems, right?
Some.
Some.
Not all,
Not all.
some. But this is where the huge disconnect comes from, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of countries, even the UK, right? You have a public health system, but again, it's also, there's also private, right? Systems
Yeah.
as well. And I think at the end of the day, yeah, this question is really interesting. And I was talking to a colleague about this because we were having almost the same discussion, but it was not about antibiotics. I was, I
Yeah.
think it was about something else. But at the same time, it's again, it's technically speaking, right? Now, from a more commercial side, it's a private company,
Yeah.
right? And private companies also have investors that they need to report to, right?
Well,
And
and
we hope that.
go on, sorry.
No, and we hope that government institutions are set up for situations like this. And so I think it's almost unfair to think that, you know, private companies need to be used in order to support public health needs. However, another argument from that side is, yeah, you're right. Who are the customers that a lot of these pharma companies are serving, right? They're technically serving a part of public health, but at the same time, if we really look at it from a very black and white perspective, it's not their job to manage a country's public health system. They
No.
can help support it, right?
Yeah.
But who manages it? And I think a lot of government institutions have frameworks available to do it, but then why is that? And I think that question is more deeper down into like, why isn't our public health system the way it actually should be? And it's not just the UK, it's not just countries across, you know,
No,
the
it's a
broader EU. It's not even just the US. Like every single country that at least I know of has major, major issues in healthcare and managing public health. And it is a big issue because, again, who are the people that are suffering, right, when public health isn't managed? It's
Yeah.
us. It's the economy,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah. I think the other thing that sometimes people forget, and politicians, I think, well, on the face of it, seem to forget this, is that if it's a public company, the people that run that public company, some of them will be directors of that public company, but all of them will have a legal liability or responsibility to the shareholders to run it in a way that is responsible. And so they open themselves up to potentially serious risk if they don't run it in a way that is deemed to be responsible. So there's an element where, you know, they have to, there's sort of like a baked in pathway here in the system, which is it's a private company. The money comes from shareholders. There's a responsibility to return a return on investment to shareholders. If that doesn't appear to be happening, or if someone's acting against that, then that opens that person up to a liability and so on and so forth. It's not quite that black and white, but it is that can't really be escaped. So this idea that like, it's, I agree. It's like it's this idea that big pharma or pharmaceutical companies should just quote do the right thing and invest investors' money in something that doesn't, that's not, that's just, that's like fairy tale thinking. It's not going to happen.
You know, you're right that it's not black and white, but if we really want to talk about some of the nuances, I mean, you're right, it's not always a fairy tale, but like every major pharma company, you know, they also have, right, it's called corporate social responsibility,
Right.
right? And UN sustainability goals, right?
Okay.
They spend hundreds of millions of dollars, right, already to kind of support a lot of these initiatives as well,
That's a
right?
good
And so I
point.
think it's really important that, you know, again, pharma companies this large, they also do support in other ways, right? Like kind of not, I don't want to say indirect, because a lot of these projects and opportunities are very direct and we know exactly where the money goes to. But like, you know, a lot of some pharma companies are tackling climate change, right? Some pharma
Right.
companies are tackling, right? And so I don't think it's necessarily fully fair to say, you know, it's the job of private companies to manage public health. But then when the world's public health system is this broken, like whose job is
Who's
it
going to
then?
do it? Right. My
Right?
producer Johan is waving frantically at me that we have to go to
Oh.
our final commercial break. So we will be back in 2 minutes with the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Sophie Park. We'll be right back.
Radio. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour, the final part of this week's show with me, Steve Roost, CEO of PocDoc, and my guest, Sophie Park, who is currently at Bayer Pharmaceuticals. So, Sophie, thanks a lot for all of that. I mean, like, I love the backwards and forwards. This is what the show's all about. So this is like absolutely perfect. In the final part of the show, I want to cover up a couple of things that I had written down. So the first one is, just, you mentioned it in the beginning, like that you've done some work in and around the White House and with those very, I don't know which administration it was, and I'm sure that there's a huge amount that you can't tell us, otherwise Secret Service will like shoot you or something. But
don't say that, because now they're tapping us now.
Yeah, okay,
they're tapping in. NSA's tapping in.
But what are the kind of general lessons or things that you learned from those sort of interactions with an institution like the White House?
You know, what's so fascinating is people always talk about how government is so slow and so mundane, right? But one of the things I really appreciated in working with our government, so it's actually two administrations. I worked both under a Republican and a Democratic administration, so Bush and then also Obama.
Okay.
During that time, what I truly appreciate is, you know, everyone knew, everyone was an expert. I almost felt like I was a black sheep, right? Because I was, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tail. I was just getting into this, right?
Okay.
And so everyone had tons of experience. And what was so amazing and the biggest thing that I learned is no idea or no vision is ever big enough.
Okay.
And I think this was really the way that a lot of the people who worked there thought, and which is kind of fascinating, because when you think government, you think, you know, slow. You think
big
organization.
Yeah, like conservative, steady eddy, don't rock the boat.
Yeah, yeah. No, but these group of people that I worked with within the Office of Innovation, I mean, they were, and Health and Human Services, like, one of the things that I found was so, I mean, it was so valuable also to me, like in a work setting, was that every single individual there had one thing in mind, and that was to serve the people that they served. And I think that was really, it was good for humility too, because, you know, from a business perspective, I mean, now I work for Big Pharma, right? We're not going to go into that. But again, like, they truly cared about what was being put out there, and no vision was big enough. And then one of the biggest things that I learned, and I still have like a screenshot of the White, I don't know if you can see this, but it's like the White House like notepad. And
oh, cool.
One of the people that worked there was, you know, dream in years, you plan in months, you evaluate in weeks, and you ship it out daily.
That's cool.
Prototype for 1x, build for 10x, and you engineer for 100x.
Right.
And I think every idea or discussion that we had, it was within these parameters, because again, when you're a government, you're not looking out for one individual person, you're not looking out for yourself, you're looking out for an entire country, right? And so I think it was really fascinating to think in that setting, because sometimes even startups, right, you say, well, yeah, there's like a couple hundred thousand people who have heart failure, you know, but it's really all couple hundred thousand when you're talking about a couple hundred million.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think that was my biggest learning. Like, nothing was ever too big. It's like they almost wanted you to think huge, right?
Yeah.
Because in order to serve at that kind of scale, you can't start small. And I think that was what was really interesting, because a lot of investors tell startups, start small and then you scale. But like, working in government was more like, no. You need to be at scale when we go out. Like, there is no test and pull back. Like, when we roll out to the VA, like, that's it.
That's the whole thing. Yeah, like,
that's
I am
the whole thing.
So it reminds me a little bit of, like, slightly different, but I don't even remember back in the day. So just before places like Shake Shack and Byron Burgers and meat liquor and all of, there was like this explosion of really good burger joints, basically. There was just like McDonald's, Burger King and stuff like that. So then all of these places started to come out, and McDonald's was getting hammered. I was like, why can't you do organic beef? Why can't you do this? Why can't you do that? Why can't you do this? And like, why can't you offer crinkly fries? And why can't you have healthier food? And like, what is it going on? And basically, I saw something from the CEO, and he was like, what we can't and won't execute on anything that we can't ship out to 200,000 stores at the same time. Like, we can't operate on a single shop level. We have to be able to build, if we do it, we're building it for the world, basically. We're not building it for one shop somewhere. We actually have to implement this. So in order, what that means is that if we go organic or whatever it is, or like a classic one was, at least in the UK, at least they didn't, there was a big kind of pushback about all of the ingredients has to be sourced from the UK, right? So all your potatoes for your fries from the UK, all your eggs for your Egg McMuffin, all your et cetera, right?
Oh,
So the guy's like,
interesting. I
well,
didn't know about this.
that's all well and good, but that means I need like a gajillion cows, a gajillion chickens, like I need like entire giant potato plantations in the
London
UK. Like,
Piccadilly is turning into a potato farm.
yeah, like he's like, I
Rooftop
we can do
green
it, right?
farm.
But that's how I plan. It's not, you know, so it's sort of similar. It's about how do you think about scale first?
But you have to also think about quality, right? And like part of what the CEO is talking about is the quality of the experience
Yes.
that the customers get, right? And I
Yeah.
think this is hugely important because, God, Steve, so many startup companies do not think about the experience.
Yeah.
Like
Yeah.
we are talking about healthcare where it is so difficult to navigate. I don't even like calling in to schedule an appointment. Like, if I can do it online, I wish to do it online. I
Yeah.
now do not look for clinics that don't have virtual scheduling, honestly, because I don't have time for that. Like, waiting on the phone for 10 minutes, you know? And it's about the experience. And at the same time, that was what was really fascinating because every idea that was put on the table was at scale. It needed to be rolled out at scale, which meant, you know, tons of work, tons of leg hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, but that's why, right? It's because of
Yeah.
the user experience, and
And
it's
that user experience needs to be consistent. Like user one to user a
exactly
million in theory has to have the same experience, which is what this McDonald's guy was going on about.
right. And then from an efficiency standpoint, it's like if there was a bug, if you were trying to register, we don't have to worry about 200,000 locations that
Yeah.
this is being scaled out, and we know exactly where the problem is, and we know exactly what we need to do to fix it. And the engineers
Yeah.
know too, right? So that's why, right?
Did
And
you
I think for,
sorry, go on.
no, I said that's what healthcare is about, right? It's not just about one person. At the same time, you have to be as personalized, but you also have to be extremely usable, and
Did
right? So
you read the book Premonition about the pandemic, the chart, the Michael Lewis one? It was have a, because I'm interested to know whether you crossed over with that group, because they were in the W found the W administration. That's like this crack group that built the first pandemic plan. It's a super
no, I
interesting
have
book if you can
not.
get a copy.
Okay, I will read that. I have not read
Yeah,
that
super
premonition.
interesting.
No.
So with the last few minutes of the show, what we normally like to do is kind of use it so that the person on can start to pass on some of their pearls of wisdom, you know, more around how they've managed to stay on their own mission, what keeps them kind of positive, how they keep going. Because everyone that we've had on the show obviously has their own personal experiences, but they're generally united by a drive, sense of purpose, mission driven, passion. And you know, we like to use these last few minutes to kind of unearth some of that stuff and sort of pass it on in the interests of sort of giving back to the listeners. So I don't know, over to you. What kind of keeps you going and keeps you on mission?
To me, it's really public health. I really believe that, you know, healthcare should is a right. And I know that's so like easier said than done, right? And you know, really what keeps me going is that there are still millions of people out there, I mean a billion plus, right? If we really include the world out there that don't have the basic access or the necessities of healthcare. And, I think in this day and age where, we have very wealthy countries, that shouldn't be the case, especially for healthcare. And really, that's what keeps me going. And, from a micro level, it's very heartwarming when you see like companies, at least from our portfolio, right? When they send me like little snippets of patients that use their products and say, "Hey, like your product has changed my life." And I'm like, "Okay, great." So, we're giving out little mentorships here and there, but then it like changes someone's life. And I think that's what's great about healthcare, because it's so personal at the time, of at the point of it's personal at the point of contact, but you can really help scale to the masses. And I think just
That's
healthcare
great.
in general needs a lot of help too. So that's
I
part of the
wouldn't
reason
disagree.
why I keep
Sophie, we've
going.
come to the end of the show. So thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great to be here. This was fun.
And thank you to everyone for listening as ever. Catch us on Spotify. Catch the rest of the UK Health Radio roster on Spotify. Thanks again for listening, and we'll be back again next week. Thank you very much.